Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel. And today I'm pleased to have with us Professor Sarah Stockwell. Professor Stockwell is Professor of Imperial and Commonwealth History at King's College London. Today we are speaking about her newest book, The British End of the British Empire. Welcome, Professor Stockwell.
Thank you very much.
Professor, what is the thesis of your book?
Well, perhaps I could just begin by saying what the book is about and what it does. So the book, it adopts a novel approach to British decolonization by focusing not on the state and imperial policymaking or on the individual and society. The two themes around which I think most accounts of decolonisation have been constructed. Instead, my focus is on the end of empire from the perspective of a set of domestic institutions that lay on the borders of the state, but which have become in various ways stakeholders in Britain's empire. And what the book argues is that during decolonisation, these institutions reconfigured their activities to adopt new roles, for example, by using their accumulated expertise to become involved in processes of post-colonial state building. And as they did this, they aimed to promote British models and practices and to maintain their own influence. So in effect, these institutions were exercising an imperialism of their own. And I suggest that whilst the institutions experienced some uncertainty and dislocation around the end of empire, that this was in other ways productive for the institutions, giving rise to new initiatives and in some cases generating new opportunities for them. And in this way, I argue that although their initiatives were sometimes of mixed success, that the institutions' activities nevertheless contributed to the persistence in an otherwise globalising world of British connections. Now, I wouldn't want to make exaggerated claims for the strength of these connections, but we need to take account of them, I think, if we're to arrive at a full understanding of the texture and breadth of British links to the post-colonial world.
And which particular sets of institutions does the book discuss?
Okay, so I focus on four institutions, the Bank of England, the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst, the Royal Mint, and the Universities of Oxford and Cambridge. The last were, of course, two separate institutions rather than one. And in the case of Oxford and Cambridge, I focus on one part of their activities, that is their involvement in training entrants for Britain's colonial service. And I chose these sets of institutions because I wanted to look at institutions whose activities related to different sectors, to public administration, to finance and to defence. And in so doing, bring together in one book discussion of British involvement in post-colonial institution building in three key sectors that in many scholarly accounts are discussed separately.
Would it be correct to say that the book's emphasis on the British Empire is primarily in sub-Saharan Africa, and that other areas of the empire, or for that matter, the Commonwealth, are not extensively examined?
Yes. The circumstances and some of the institutional issues were different in India, as was obviously the chronology of decolonization. And in this book, I'm principally concerned with what we might think of as a second phase of British decolonization, that which commences in the late 1950s and continues through in the 1960s. And although I discuss this second phase of decolonization principally with reference to British Africa, many of the things I consider, some of the initiatives developed by different institutions, do nonetheless apply equally to colonies in other regions like the Caribbean, although generally not to South Asia.
You seem to argue at length that the British were singularly at fault in failing to prepare its colonies in sub-Saharan Africa for independence. Is it not the case that in some fashion you seem to be arguing that the retreat from empire from 1957 to 1964 in its rapidity was something of an error in retrospect?
Okay, so I very definitely do argue that the British failed to prepare their colonies for independence. Very little was done by way of, for example, education until too late. But I wouldn't argue that, therefore, the retreat from empire between 1957 and 64 was a mistake. One reason that the British, like other European colonial powers, did so little to prepare the colonies was because they assumed that independence was a long way off and would occur at a more leisurely pace than turned out to be the case. But there were other factors as well which held back processes of state building. For example, a reluctance to promote non-whites to positions of authority in the public services and armed forces in the colonies. And this reluctance would have applied whenever the transition to independence occurred. And it was only the prospect of imminent independence that pushed the British into action, especially in the settler colonies in East and Central Southern Africa.
What do you mean when you refer to the, quote, Janus-faced British state, unquote, as per decolonization?
Okay. Post-war British decolonization was more protracted than that of other European powers. You know, it began in 1947 in South Asia. It continued through the 1950s and 60s and then into the 1970s and 80s before culminating in the handover of Hong Kong to China in 1997. And even today, there are still a handful of British overseas territories, former colonies which over which Britain still exercises sovereignty. And as a result, in the 1950s and 60s, while one part of the British state was concerned with dealing with the still continuing empire, those places that remained under British control, another was adjusting to a post-colonial world and managing Britain's relations with its former colonies. So some of the architecture of the old imperial state was repurposed to deliver aid to newly independent Commonwealth countries, while also still catering to Britain's remaining dependencies. And I conceptualise this as the Janus-faced imperial state, drawing on the Roman god, Janus, who looks simultaneously to the past and to the future, because I think that captures the position that the British were in the 1950s and early 1960s. Perhaps I could give you one example, and that is the Oxbridge Colonial Service training course. In the late 50s and very early 1960s, Oxford and Cambridge began admitting students from newly independent and decolonising countries to these courses to assist with the training of a local class of civil servants. But remarkably, these students from independent African states and other former colonies were sitting alongside Britons who were still doing the year-long training course in preparation for a career in the colonial service, creating a very anomalous and, as I say, in many ways remarkable situation.
Would it be correct to say that concretely Oxbridge got out of the Devonshire courses for training of colonial servants, civil servants, primarily money, or I suppose grants through the committee which dispersed such things, the University Grants Committee?
I think in an earlier period, so the interwar years, the training courses developed in the interwar period and were then beefed up for the late 1940s. I think in the 1930s and the 1940s, there was some sort of prestige attached to this role, and it thought appropriate for Oxford and Cambridge to be participating in the training of a class of administrators who were going out to fulfil in a particular role in the empire. But they did also get money for delivering the colonial service courses. And this became particularly important to them in the post-war era. There was an expansion in the training, colonial service training at that point, and this enabled the universities to make new appointments in areas like imperial history or anthropology. And at the end of empire, those who were involved in the delivery of these courses, and more particularly those who were in post that were funded as a result of the money they received from the British imperial state, naturally sought to protect their own jobs and their own specialisms, arguing for the continuation of the training courses. And so as a result, and really quite extraordinarily in many ways, the courses continued, albeit in a revised form, even after the Colonial Office ceased to recruit expatriates on pensionable terms for the colonial service. So by the mid-1960s, what had been courses for entrance to the colonial service had been rebranded as development courses, catering almost exclusively to students from Britain's former colonies. They were then funded by the Ministry of Overseas Development as part of the package of Britain's technical assistance to new states. Oxford's course finally ceases in 1969, although Oxford at that point retained a role in training foreign diplomats, which was an activity that had developed alongside some of the training of entrance to public administration in new states. But Cambridge, the Cambridge course only ceased in 1981, albeit that it had gone through various iterations by that point. It's at that stage that the British government withdrew its funding. But legacies of both courses still exist today at Oxford and Cambridge.
Would it be correct to say that overall the Devonshire courses did not impact, or did not impact greatly, the two universities as a whole?
I think that by the 1950s and 60s, the role is relatively marginal to the two universities. But the involvement in teaching not just entrance to the colonial service, but entrance to other imperial services, I think has a not insignificant impact on the two universities. And the admission of overseas students in larger numbers, particularly at the end of empire, contributes to both, you know, the internationalisation at both institutions. So yes and no, I think.
At one point in the book, you argue, or at least appear to argue, that Gallagher and Robinson's theory of the informal empire was influenced by, quote, the experience of teaching African and other non-Europeans at Oxbridge, unquote. Surely this is a little bit far-fetched in speculative terms.
When you say I appear to argue, I suggest it might have been, but I can't say so conclusively. Both were involved in teaching the students on these, the colonial service probationers on the training courses at Oxford and Cambridge. Both were teaching in imperial history, and both were there at sort of key transformational moment in the 1950s. For example, Jack Gallagher, towards the end of, I can't remember the exact date, but sometime towards the end of the 1950s, introduces a course on nationalism in former colonies. And behind much of what the British state did and what British institutions were doing at the end of empire was a desire to maintain influence, to replace rule with influence, if you like. And Gallagher and Robinson were both actively contributing to that in their involvement, or through their involvement in these courses and the training of students coming from former colonies to Oxbridge to study. And it seems to me that they would have learned something from what the events that they were witnessing around them. And the 1953 article that they wrote on informal empire, it's about the 19th century, but nonetheless, one could draw parallels with the period of post-war decolonization. And indeed, many years after he co-wrote the article in 1953 with Jack Gallagher, Ronald Robinson wrote a second influential article with the American historian Roger Lewis. And that article is called The Imperialism of Decolonization. And the title was designed to echo the 1953 article he'd written with Jack Gallagher. And that article was about the continuation of empire in new forms after post-war decolonization.
To go on to our next institution, what was the Bank of England's initial view of colonial central banks, and why did that view change in the course of your examination in the book?
Okay, so the Bank of England was initially very hostile towards the prospect that the colonies would establish their own central banks and issue their own currencies. It was hostile partly because it saw these developments as contrary to the interests of Stirling and the City of London. And the bank's officials also had a very conservative approach and thought that the colonies lacked the conditions that were necessary for the successful development of independent central banks. And they did everything they could to resist a process of financial devolution in the colonies. But once it became clear, and this is around the mid-1950s, that the bank couldn't stop this trend, the bank's officials decided it was better to assist the colonies so that they could exercise some control over the process, and in that way prevent the colonies seeking assistance from other countries and organisations like the World Bank, whose approach was somewhat different to the Bank of England. And the bank, I think, also recognised that if the colonies were to acquire their own central banks and currencies, it was important to the political and economic stability of the Commonwealth and the sterling area that these new institutions were as sound as possible. So for multiple reasons, the bank wanted to exert as much influence as it possibly could, and this brought about the change in its approach.
Why did not the Bank of England, the UK, establish a currency board akin to what France had until very recently in sub-Saharan Africa, something which appears to have given France a considerable amount of influence in its those particular former colonies which were part of the scheme?
Okay, so the French approach was different to the British. Former French colonies were members of the franc zone, but also received a currency that was issued, or coins and notes that were issued by regional central banks that were established at independence. In the British case, I don't think that former British colonies would have accepted that situation. They were keen to attain their own national institutions, which they saw as emblematic of independent statehood. This was the source of pressure on the Bank of England in the first instance to go along with the development of central banks. So I think politically, it would have been impossible for the Bank of England to impose an alternative set of arrangements. But it's important to remember that at independence, former British colonies did remain as members of the sterling area. And that meant that they continued to peg their currencies to sterling and to maintain their reserves in sterling. So in the British case, there also continued to be very strong financial links between Britain and its former colonies. And indeed, it was to preserve and protect the interests of the sterling area that the Bank of England was very keen. This was why the Bank of England was very keen to exercise control over the process of creating new central banks and issuing currencies.
Did the Bank of England, insofar as it is possible to ascertain, see itself as pursuing specific British interests, or did it more operate in such fashion that it was more autonomous, operating as more as an autonomous operator?
Okay, so the Bank of England had been nationalised by the post-war Labour government in 1946. So it was technically part of the British state, but it still retained considerable autonomy. And the initiatives that it developed in relation to the colonial empire were done so really with very little reference to the British government. For example, one of the things I discuss is a training course that the Bank of England started in 1957, and which they continued to offer thereafter every 2 years to bankers from Commonwealth central banks. And they developed that really quite independently of the British Treasury. What were they doing in doing this? Well, partly they were promoting national interests. Because defending the position of sterling as an international currency and promoting the sterling area, they would deem that in British national interests as well as in the Bank of England's interests. But I would argue that they also acted in their own interests insofar as they hoped to establish through their activities a network of central bankers within the Commonwealth. And they wanted Commonwealth central banks to be as independent as possible of their governments. They thought that was important for the stability of currencies in independent states, but they also wanted there to be this class of central bankers who would liaise and collaborate and meet independently of governments. And I'd say that's their agenda rather than, in this instance, also promoting something they perceive within national interests.
So it's not the case that the Treasury, say Sir Edward Bridges or Sir Norman Brooke, was giving directions to the Bank of England in this particular area?
No, not at all.
How our next institution, which is the Royal Mint, how dependent was the Royal Mint on sub-Saharan Africa for orders circa the mid-1950s?
The Mint was primarily a domestic institution. Its purpose is to produce coin for domestic use. But in the course of the 19th century, it had started producing overseas coinages. And by the Second World War, the production of some overseas coinages had become important to the Mint's overall function. For example, in years when it didn't need to produce much coin for domestic use, it was able to keep plant going and staff busy by producing these overseas coinages. And in the 1940s, after the Second World War, it received a sort of high volume of orders from from Britain's colonies, particularly in Africa, and was making a profit from them. And these colonial customers were, in effect, tied customers because the orders were placed by British officers and the colonies really had no choice in where they went to obtain this coin. So it had become important to the business model for the Mint.
Would it be correct to say that the decline of empire had little effect on the Royal Mint's business model and success?
Initially, the Mint was very concerned that as the colonies sought to issue their own currencies, that they might purchase the coin from other exporting mints, including some within the British Empire, and that they would lose the business of these customers. But they succeeded, in fact, in securing the orders for coin for really almost all British colonies. I'm trying to think of a case where they didn't in the late 1950s and the early 1960s, and I can't. And in fact, as a result, they were not only able to retain their existing old colonial business, but expand it. And we have the very sort of ironic situation in some ways that it was a British institution that produced and in some cases designed the coins and even independence medals that were issued by new states to signal their independence, to commemorate their independence from Britain. And for the Mint, I argue that the business of ending empire proved very profitable.
Our next institution, the final one, which is Sandhurst, would it be correct to say that while Sandhurst remained or became very popular with both sub-Saharan African and other former British colonies throughout the world, as a practical matter, the tangible benefits of such popularity was very limited, nothing or very little by way of, say, military-to-military influence, or for that matter, arms sales, except for perhaps the Persian Gulf.
So Sandhurst, the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst, is different to the other institutions that I study in the book, insofar as it hadn't chosen its role at the end of empire, the training of overseas cadets. Instead, that role was sort of forced on it by various government departments, the Foreign Office, the Colonial Office, the Commonwealth Relations Office, who all for different reasons sought, well, related reasons, but aiming at different cohorts, sought to use the academy as an instrument of British soft power. And that was of considerable consequence for Sandhurst, because by the late 1950s, about one-sixth of all cadets were from overseas, leading to some tensions within the academy. Your question about the impact on transfer of military technology. Could you just repeat the question for me, please? I'm not sure I caught the whole question there.
Certainly. In terms of the aspect of tangible benefits coming from this soft power, in particular things like, say, military-to-military influence or arms sales.
It's very difficult to measure what impact the Sandhurst effect had. It's not something that I primarily set out to do in my book. I was describing the effect on Sandhurst rather than on armies overseas. But nonetheless, the British authorities, both at Sandhurst and in the army more generally, believed that it was useful to have a diaspora of Sandhurst alumni in the armies of new Commonwealth states. They thought that it might not so much actually perpetuate British models, because it became clear quite quickly that that wasn't necessarily the case, as the militaries became politicized and you get the pattern of post-colonial coups. But rather that it gave them a connection to the military in Commonwealth countries. And indeed, sort of rather cynically, the British authorities, witnessing the trend towards military coups in former British colonies in Africa, believed that the influence of the military in politics in post-colonial Africa made it all the more important that the British had connections to the military through, for example, the training at Sandhurst. But they also hoped, and indeed believed there was evidence, that receiving a British army training where cadets might use British military hardware might encourage a pattern of purchase of British arms. And there is some evidence of a correlation between the pattern of British military exports and training at Sandhurst. But it's circumstantial, and it is difficult to reach firm conclusions about what you phrase as the tangible benefits that came from using Sandhurst as this instrument of soft power.
Now, aside from the influx of, as you say, at one point, one-sixth of all cadets were from former British colonies, was there any other institutional changes at Sandhurst as a result of this particular influx?
The authorities at Sandhurst, as I said, become worried about race relations at different points. But in other respects, they make very few changes initially to cater to this influx of overseas cadets, not least because the whole purpose of their admission, the admission of these overseas cadets to Sandhurst, was to sort of spread British influence and to expose them to British practice. But in the 1970s, they make more concessions to the presence of these overseas cadets, adapting some of the sort of social and cultural aspects of life at Sandhurst to their presence. But there are some curious consequences that result from this influx of overseas cadets from the 1950s. For example, some of those teaching at Sandhurst, and I'm thinking here of individuals who were on the academic staff rather than soldiers, some of the academics become interested in researching aspects of colonial military history. There's one man who taught at Sandhurst after the Second World War, who became involved in recording songs that African soldiers would sing to him, and creating a record of those. So in possibly unexpected ways, you see some legacies there. And of course, Sandhurst continues to this day to admit very large numbers of overseas cadets. In the later 20th century and the early 21st century, those have tended to be drawn from Gulf states rather than from the Commonwealth. But you can see a sort of continuous process of admission of overseas cadets from, you know, the 1940s to the present day.
Compared to the French, British involvement appears, at any rate, in terms of sub-Saharan Africa, with the end of empire to have been rather limited. Was that an outcome that the UK wanted, or the UK did not want but could not do anything about?
That's a good question. I think it's fair to say, as you do, that the British did intervene less in the affairs of former British colonies in sub-Saharan Africa than the French did. But we need, of course, to remember that the British Empire was larger and more geographically far-flung than the French. And as a result, in the period after decolonisation, British post-colonial aid has been dispersed amongst a correspondingly larger set of recipients and across more regions. But even though British involvement and intervention, for example, in military intervention, for instance, is less significant than the French, British involvement in post-colonial Africa has nevertheless been extensive. Britain was keen that the colonies should look to Britain for assistance, rather than to some other donor countries, particularly Russia. And obviously this is a reflection of the Cold War context of the time. But it's also fair to say that while some former African colonies were important to Britain strategically or economically, for example, Nigeria or Kenya, other African states were of much more marginal importance, and yet Britain found it difficult to extricate itself from the provision of substantial technical assistance to them. And there are points, beginning in the mid-1960s and at different instances thereafter, where British officials complain that the pattern of British overseas aid didn't necessarily correspond to the pattern of British overseas interests. And they would like to see more aid directed away from Africa and towards other regions of the world.
Would it be correct to say that the book's overall emphasis is at variance with Bernard Porter's argument that the empire had little domestic effect on the UK?
Yes, I think it would be. I mean, I argue that institutions that were primarily domestic were nevertheless shaped to various degrees by empire. And more especially, I argue that developments in the mid-20th century on the eve of or during decolonisation reinforced and in some ways intensified the institution's engagement with Africa in particular. And crucially, what I hope the book does is show that this British involvement didn't cease at the end of empire. Instead, because really a process of state building starts with sort of flag independence, i.e. that is because the colonies enter independence so ill prepared, there's an extended period of state building thereafter. And because the British and British institutions and the British state are involved in that by offering a variety of forms of technical assistance. This ensures that not only the end of empire left many legacies in Britain itself, but that there are numerous ongoing connections between institutions and individuals in Britain and its former colonies. So to give you one illustration, or two illustrations, at the end of empire, there are many more overseas students enrolled on courses in Britain than there'd been previously, and a very large number of them come from Commonwealth countries. But the end of empire also saw many thousands of Britons still employed in the public services of former colonies, especially in Africa. Indeed, in one case, Zambia, a few years after independence, there were even more Britons employed in the public services of the country than there had been in the colonial era. So not only do I start from the position really that, yes, empire did have an impact on the UK, but we need to also take account of the very extensive engagement of Britain, Britons and British institutions in the Commonwealth after the end of empire.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
I think really sort of following on from the point I've just made, that independence is the starting point of a process of state building, and a point and that there is this ongoing extensive British involvement at the end of empire. So the end of empire isn't the end. It's the beginning of a new phase of British involvement. Secondly, that the process of decolonisation in Britain and its impact in Britain, I don't think end of empire is traumatic, at least for the institutions I've looked at and the individuals in them, in the way that some people have argued, although political developments around the end of empire brought uncertainty for many people, in some cases loss of career, etc. But rather that Britons and those working in these institutions sort of pragmatically got on with adjusting to the changing situation, adapting their activities to ensure that the organisations in which they worked had an ongoing role, and above all, that they both believed that Britain should and could exercise significant influence at the end of empire in the affairs of former colonies.
With that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Stockwell, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Coutillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Stockwell.
Thank you for talking to me about my book.